If you've experienced a DNA surprise, you know that your emotions can range from shock to denial to grief to anger to confusion to joy and around again. And sometimes it's hard to find people who understand this unique experience. Sometimes we feel a little stuck as we navigate this journey. That's why we created the DNA Surprise Retreat. At the DNA Surprise Retreat, you'll enjoy 6 expert-led sessions to help you process your DNA surprise. You'll eat delicious catered meals, and most importantly, you'll build beautiful friendships with people who understand you, all in a stunning private ranch facility in the Arizona desert. If you've had shocking DNA test results, know that you're not alone. This retreat is for you. Join us September 19th through the 22nd, 2024 in Phoenix, Arizona. Registration is open now. Reserve your space at dnasurpriseretreat.com. I'll see you there.
I was hospitalized in March of 2019, and Karen is very outspoken and will answer questions, that sort of thing. So I'm in the hospital, and the doctor comes in, and he's just asking general doctor questions. And so he goes, "What about your dad? Did your dad have any health issues?" And before anybody could speak, Karen goes, "Yeah, dad had cancer. He died in 1996. He had cancer." And I looked and I said, "We don't have the same dad." And the doctor's face, you would have thought I just had blown up the whole family mystery. The doctor's face, he looked horrified. And I said, "It's okay." I said, "She is still getting used to it, as am I. We do not have the same father." And, you know, of course, the doctor was, I think, was quite pleased with that bit of information. But that's just an example of, you know, it's taken a while for us to realize, you know, that we are different in some way.
Imagine spitting into a tube, sending off your DNA, and unknowingly turning your life upside down. For me and thousands of others, this is our reality. I'm your host, Alexis Auerselt. In July of 2021, I discovered that I am an NPE, someone who has experienced a non-paternal event. In other words, my biological father isn't who I thought he was. This podcast shares the journeys of people who were shocked by a DNA discovery, mostly through modern DNA testing. We're telling the stories of NPEs, adoptees, and donor-conceived people and their families. This is DNA Surprises. Before we begin this week's episode, I want to add a content warning that there are references to mental health, depression, and suicide in this episode. If you or anyone you know are struggling with thoughts of suicide or self-harm, please call the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline at 1-800-273-8255. Michael had long suspected that he was an NPE, but it took decades for him to learn the truth. By the time Michael learned about his father, both of his biological parents had Alzheimer's and were unable to answer his questions. In this episode, he shares about how his new relationships are progressing, his healing process, and his mental health. Thank you, Michael, for sharing your story.
Michael Allen, I'm 55 years old, and I'm from Richmond, Virginia. The official date was October 16th, 2017. But it is something that I've suspected for primarily most of my adult life. When I was younger, in the, say, the 12 to 14-year-old age, I was the biggest, and back then biggest was described as tallest, but I was the biggest person in the family. And so even with my brothers, it would be a big joke when I would be with them, and they would say, "Hey, this is my little brother," and then the little brother is bigger than them. even though they were considerably older than me. And so that was kind of weird. And, you know, you're not real sure what's going on at that point in your life. But you just kind of felt like you're a little bit out of sorts, so to speak. And so as time went on, when I was 22 years old, my son was born. And when he was born, I looked at him and I looked at his mother and I looked at myself, and I could see how his mother and I created him and how it all kind of fit naturally, whether it was hair color or skin tone or something of that nature. And so that just added to my suspicions that something just wasn't adding up, that something was amiss, if you will. And so as time went on, you know, back 33 years ago when he was born, you know, DNA wasn't as prevalent as it is now, and it certainly wasn't commercialized as it is now. And so there's really no resources, nor did I have the gumption to go out and find it. And so time just went on, and periodically throughout my life, people would ask me very casually, has anybody ever told you you don't look like your family? And, you know, after a while, I would just say, yes, I've been told that. So I started dating my current girlfriend, Kimberly, 12 years ago. And when I started dating her, she said the same thing. She asked me the same question. Had anyone ever told me I didn't look like anyone in my family? And, of course, I shared with her that, in fact, I had been asked that. But then, you know, I told her that I had never talked to anybody else about it. And so when the 23andMe and the Ancestry commercialized testing became more and more prevalent, my two sisters that I grew up with, even though they're considerably older, they got all into the DNA. They were all excited about it and the background and the, hey, you know, did you know that we were X amount, you know, European? And did you know that we had ancestries from, you know, ABC country, et cetera, et cetera? And none of that really interested me, but they were all about it. At some point in time, my sister Karen called me. I was living in North Carolina at the time. And she called me and she said, hey, if I pay for the DNA test, will you take it? So I said, yes. And I hung the phone up. I literally hung the phone up and called my girlfriend. And my exact quote was, the shit's getting ready to hit the fan.
Wow.
And I told her about my conversation with Karen. You know, time went on. And this was in 2017. And so the results came back. So then when the results came back, Karen's like, hey, you can share my results, and I'll share my results, and we can compare, and et cetera, et cetera. When Karen and I shared our profiles with each other, I would ask her stuff that I knew she didn't have an answer to. I'll just give you an example. Like I said, hey, cousin Tommy, how come cousin Tommy shows up on yours, but he doesn't show up on mine? Why would that be? And then I said, who's this Tracy girl? I said, this Tracy girl, she's on mine. She's pretty high on mine, but she's not on yours. Why is that? Well, my sister, when you stump her, she gets really, really quiet. I mean, really, really quiet. And I had stumped her. And so at some point, we ended that conversation. And I don't know the exact time frame. But it couldn't have been more than a couple weeks. Karen calls me, and my girlfriend and I, Kimberly, we were in Virginia Beach, and we were having lunch. I just sat down to eat lunch, and the phone rang, and I was like, well, I'm not going to answer that. And then it immediately rang a second time, and I was like, no, I'm not going to answer that. It immediately rang a third time, and I said, oh, my goodness, something must be wrong with Mom. Because Mom, at that time, before she passed away, lived with Karen. So I answered the phone, and she said, are you with Kimberly? And I said, yeah, we're sitting here eating lunch together. And she starts crying. She says, it's true. We don't have the same biological father. And my exact words to her were, it's okay. I've known my entire life. Now, once that happened, I did later go through the different stages of grief. I went through not so much denial, but I certainly went through anger. I went through blame because I blamed her and my other sister, Bonnie, that certainly they must have known something. Since they're so much older than me, certainly they knew something. And they swore, and they still to this day say they never had a clue, never had an inkling about it. And I do believe them.
How much older than you are they?
12 and 14 years.
You had suspected all along. And when you kind of posed those questions to your sister, instead of telling her, did you want her to reach her own conclusion? Or why did you kind of pose it as a question to her about the results?
I think because I was petrified, for one, because I didn't know what kind of reaction anyone would have to this. And if there was some logical explanation for why this was showing what it was, I didn't want to be accused of perhaps thinking I didn't belong to Dad, only to be later proven that I was wrong and I really did belong to him. And he was going to find the answer. I knew that. And in fact, she was extremely instrumental in me finding my bio. I call him Bio Dad. My dad, I grew up with his dad, and then my bio dad. And that's how we differentiated.
Mm-hmm.
But she was extremely beneficial in what have you with helping me find bio dad.
Once it was kind of out in the open, what did you do next? Did you ask your mom for the truth? Did your mom know?
I did not ask mom. At that time, mom had Alzheimer's, and she died about 8 months later, give or take. And quite honestly, I was too afraid to ask her. I was petrified to ask her. Mom and I we were extremely close, extremely close. I was a consummate mama's boy as a child. Part of that was because I was a baby. Part of that because of the circumstances. I was essentially an only child living in the house from the time I was in second grade on. I was virtually an only child because I was the only one that lived there. And so mom and I were extremely close. One Thanksgiving, all the siblings are there. It was five of us together. We were all there, and they were just teasing mom relentlessly. Who's your favorite child, mom? Who's your favorite child? And mom would say all the proper things, you know, oh, I love all my children equally, and they're all wonderful people, and I can't choose one over the other. And they kept pressing her. And finally, she said, Michael, it's Michael. He's my favorite. And it didn't upset anyone because everyone knew. Everyone already knew that answer. So no one was upset. Nobody's feelings got hurt because that is exactly what they expected her to say. So I was too scared to ask her. One, because of her mental health, mental capacity at that time. And two, I just didn't want to lose what I'd had for 51 years.
You never spoke to your mom about it. You said your sister helped you track down your bio dad. How did you kind of put those pieces together without talking to your mom about what happened before you were born?
Okay, so Karen came to me and she said, you know, I've been researching this. And because she was so much more familiar with DNA anyway, because they had been all about it prior to this discovery, she was certainly more familiar with the system, more familiar with what it offered and what you could find out and those sort of things. So she calls me one day and she says, I've been doing some research and I think I've got it narrowed down to the family. And I said, okay. She says, it's either going to be one of two brothers or the oldest son of one of those brothers. I said, okay. And I was like, how did you come to this? And she went through the science part of it the best that she could to describe it to me. And so at that point, I decided that I would reach out to Tracy, who was the person who was the highest on my list that was not on anyone else's. So I sent Tracy a message and just to briefly explain the situation. And she almost immediately came back to me. She says, I have no idea, but I'm going to put you in touch with my dad. I said, okay, that'd be wonderful. So at some point in time, moving forward, her dad contacts me. His name is Steve. First by email, and then later we talked on the phone. But he contacts me by email, and he says, I understand that my uncle or my dad or is the father of you. And I said, yeah. So what he did was, I said, if I pay for a test, will you take the test? Well, but uncle, Pat is his name. He says, I think it's going to be Pat. And I said, okay, can you put me in touch with somebody there? So they put me in touch with Cousin Pat. And Cousin Pat calls me. And I'll never forget it. I was sitting there. I was eating dinner in a restaurant all by myself. And the phone rings. And Pat said, I hear that we might be brothers. And I said, well, I don't know. I said, but here's the situation. And so I said the same thing to Pat. I said, if I pay for a test, will you take the test? He said, absolutely, I will do that. So we arranged for the test and came back. And he came back and showed that he was a cousin of mine as opposed to a half-brother. I remember my very first reaction was, I'm so glad it's not his brother, because his older brother would have been about 20 years younger than mom. And emotionally and mentally, I had a real problem with that. And so I was thankful that it wasn't him. They called him Buttons. I was thankful it wasn't Buttons. And I was thankful to Pat for taking the test. So at that point, once that came back, I reached back out to Steve and I asked Steve the same thing again. I said, if I pay for the test, will you take the test? And I'll never forget what Steve said. Oh, he goes, I don't need the test. He goes, you look more like Dad than the rest of us. And it about floored me.
Wow.
And I said, just for my own satisfaction, will you still take it? And he said, yes, I'll take it. And so he took the test. And of course, it came back. It showed that we shared the same father. And so that's kind of how that all occurred. I mean, you have to have a little bit of luck along the way. Certainly, Tracy taking the test mm-hmm. was some luck along the way. But the other kind of funny part that I later found out about was Tracy was given the DNA test as a gift from her mother-in-law. And she really had, and this is according to Tracy, she really had no interest in taking it. She had no interest in doing it. But she took it because it came from her mother-in-law and, you know, we got to keep peace in the family kind of thing.
Right.
And so she took the test and luckily she did. And so that was really the big break that wow. was needed to find it.
It is amazing how it's just all these kind of coincidences that can help lead you to solve the mystery of, you know, who is the biological father in these cases.
Right. Absolutely.
So after you connected with your brother, how did you move forward? Were you interested in pursuing a relationship with them?
Number one interest was finding out medical history. That was number one. I had come to the conclusion at a very early on that I might get rejected, and I had to be ready for that. So mentally, was I ready for it? I don't know. But in my head, I said I was ready for it, that if I was rejected, then that's just the way it was going to be. So after it was confirmed, Steve is the second oldest. Patricia is the oldest. And so Patricia calls one night. And we're talking on the phone. And, of course, anytime during this whole process, anybody's story or discovery, you know, it's always the what ifs, or how did this happen, or where did this happen, or what were the circumstances surrounding it. You know, it's the million questions that we all go through that you'll never know the answer to. Absolutely, we'll never know the answer. And so Patricia calls me, and, you know, she introduces herself, because I'd never spoken to her, never emailed with her or anything like that. And so we talked, and she says, I want to tell you something. She said, I read the email traffic between you and Steve, and I want you to know that our dad worked for the city of Richmond. Now, my mom worked at the city of Richmond for some 40-plus years. And I was like, oh, really? And she's like, yes. She goes, I'm thinking that's how they met. And so I was like, well, to be honest with you, I have no better theory than that. And so in the time frame matches up, the mid-60s is when he worked for the city. And my mom worked full-time outside the home, even as far back as the 60s. So she was certainly out of the norm, so to speak, for that time period. But she did work outside the home full-time. Patricia and I had a really good conversation. And so that was really the, I guess, first kind of question that perhaps we had an answer to, outside of obviously who the buyer dad was. So we move forward. So now there's four of them. I grew up the youngest of five. There's four of them. And I think it's kind of funny. I get a little chuckle out of it. But I actually have a brother named Michael. but he has chosen not to meet me or hadn't taken the time to meet me when he was in the area, et cetera. Okay. And then I have a younger half-sibling, Carol. And so out of the four of them, the two oldest have accepted me, accepted the circumstances. We have dinner together perhaps once a quarter or so. I have regular contact with them. I'll just randomly ask them questions. Did buyer dad own a motorcycle? Did buyer dad have dark skin or light skin? Just very random questions right out of the blue, and they'll always answer me. Whereas the two youngest, Carol and Michael, have chosen not to have anything to do with me at this moment.
Hmm. Have they given any indication of why?
Well, I was told all along that Michael would love to meet me. Bio Dad died a year ago in September, and Michael lives in Florida. And so Michael came up for the funeral, and they said, you know, while he's here, certainly he'll want to meet you. Certainly he'll want to meet you. You know, I don't know everything that's going on in his life, but at that time was not a good time. And so he chose not to make arrangements and make time to see me or meet me, nor has he reached out at the urging of Patricia and Steve. As far as Carol is concerned, all I understand from Carol is that she was a daddy's girl, and her daddy would never do that. And I 100% understand that, because my mom would never do that, you know. In my heart, my mom would never do that. And here we are. It happened. I have nothing to gain by pushing the issue. But I do want to definitely mention when Bio Dad died, Steve and Patricia, they told their family, they said, viewing at the funeral home is going to be from 2 to 4. And if you have no interest in meeting Michael or his girlfriend, Kimberly, you need to be out by 4 o'clock. And so about 4:05, Patricia texts me and she said, okay, Michael, it's okay to come in. And so it allowed us to go in and it allowed me to grieve the best I could. At that point, I had had two conversations with BioCAD, but he had Alzheimer's and he was also blind. So he had no clue who I was.
He didn't have any real memory or anything of your mom.
Well, there's a little bit of a funny story to that. At first, Steve is married to Diane, and Diane, in a strange way, reminds me of my mom, and I'll tell you how. Mom knew so much history about the police, and Diane is the same way with the family that she married into. She knows so much about that family that if I want a quick answer and I need an answer just to satisfy my own curiosity, it's Diane that I text. And so it was Diane and Steve that said, hey, would you have any interest in meeting? And so Steve chose not to accompany us, but Diane took me, and it was just me and her, and we went to the nursing home where he lived. And like I said, he was blind, he had Alzheimer's, but I was absolutely fascinated to sit there and talk to him, because you're probably familiar with Alzheimer's patients in that they have long-term memory, but they don't know what they had for breakfast this morning. And him and I sat there and talked, and it was so fun. He had so much fun. And every once in a while, he would say, now, who are you again? And I would always just say, my name is Michael, and I'm a friend of your son, Steve. And he'd go, okay. And then we'd go back to talking.
Mm.
The first visit, the first thing he said, I asked him, I said, when you were a little boy, what did you like to do for fun? And he said, baseball, football, basketball, that involved the ball I was playing. And that was me as a child. That was me as a child. I was the kid that never left the house without a ball or a glove or a bat or to wherever we were going. So after that visit, Kimberly and I arranged to go see him. And so Kimberly and I go to the nursing home, and we go into his room, and he's not there. And they're like, oh, he's down at the barber getting his hair cut. I'm like, okay, let's go over there. So we walked in, and the barber goes, they called him, my old dad, they called him Bubs. And when I walked in, the barber said, Bubs, that must be your son, because he looks exactly like you. And so we kind of got a kick out of that.
Wow.
Now, Bubs, you know, my dad didn't react to it. He didn't say, who is it? Or, you know, none of that registered with him. But for him to say that, I thought it was quite funny. And so, anyway, he finishes with his haircut. And they allowed us to take him back to his room. And so, at that point, I decided I would basically, for the lack of a better way of saying it, I would play 20 questions with him. And I was going to videotape it. And so I videoed it. And so I said, hey, Steve tells me you used to be in the Coast Guard. He goes, yeah, I was in the Coast Guard. And I said, well, how long were you in the Coast Guard? He said, oh, 2 or 3 years. Oh, okay. And so I said, well, Steve told me you used to work at Reynolds Aluminum. He goes, yeah, I worked there. And I said, well, how long did you work there? He said, oh, 2 or 3 years. Well, everything was 2 to 3 years. So then I said, Steve told me you used to work for the city of Richmond. He goes, yeah, I worked for the city of Richmond. And I said, of course, I said, how many years? How long did you work there? And he goes, oh, 2 or 3 years. So I said, you know what's really funny? I said, my mom worked for the city of Richmond. And he was like, she did? I was like, yeah, she really did. He goes, well, what was her name? And I've got it on video, and I've shown Steve and Patricia and Diane. He stopped right in his tracks. And then he finally said, I feel like I know that name from my past, but I can't put a finger on it. And it was a pretty neat moment, actually, to be real honest with you. It was a pretty neat moment.
Wow, yeah. It was like some validation, probably.
That was the last time I was able to see him because he eventually died in September of 2020. And it was kind of crazy.
I'm sorry for your loss. I'm sure, though, it was great that you were able to actually get to connect with him before he passed and have some of those answers and get to kind of sit with him and see him, even if it wasn't necessarily his, you know, full self in the room with you.
Absolutely. And he, I got a picture of him. I have I get a running log printed so I can keep track of my miles, how many miles I run in a given year. And so the following year, his picture and my picture were on the front cover of that book. Steve and Diane and Patricia have just been wonderful to me about it. They've given me pictures along the way. They allowed me to take these two VHS tapes and go have them converted over to a thumb drive so I could watch video of him as a young person. That was pretty fascinating. The one thing, and I've never, ever, ever, out of this whole process, I have never felt like I've missed out on something, or I've never felt like, gee, they had a better life than me, or any of that kind of thing, because I had a good life. I had a good life. But I have to admit, the one time I was jealous that Michael played in the 1967 World Series, Little League World Series in Williamsport, Pennsylvania. And Bio Dad was involved with his baseball. And that was really the only time I ever can remember being jealous, because growing up, my dad was not involved with my life. He was there. He provided for us. He was never there emotionally. He was never there for, you know, ball games. But as a child, he was not available.
Mm.
And so that was really the only time that I can say I got jealous.
Did your dad ever find out the truth? Is he still alive?
No, my dad died in 1996. And for a while there was a lot of anger I had because mom had 20 good years of sound mental capacity in which to sit me down and tell me the real story. And she chose not to. But, you know, I have to realize at that point, the lie had gone on for 30 years. Why bring it up now? What do we have to gain by this? You know, and even 20 years ago, who would have thought DNA would have been commercialized where you could buy a kit and test yourself and have it sent off? You know, people just didn't see that happening. So I have to understand why mom did what she did and just kept keeping that secret to herself. And the best I can tell, she kept that secret to her. Just I called my Aunt Judy, mom's sister, and asked her, did she know anything about this? And she said, Michael, she said, I have no idea. I didn't know that. I had no idea. And so mom didn't even tell the sister that she was closest to. And then the other person, and unfortunately, she just passed away in the very, very recent past. But she was kind of like the family matriarch. And so initially, no one knows how to handle this, but initially they were, you know, of the thinking, we need to kind of keep this quiet because, you know, it's embarrassing and it's embarrassing to mom and we don't want to tarnish mom's name and that sort of thing. And I did not get into it with them, but I was quite angry by that because, you know, I felt like this is my story. It's not their story. Well, my sister Bonnie was extremely close with my aunt who just recently passed away. And she was dad's sister. And so Bonnie went to her and asked her and told her the story and asked her, did she know anything? And I am so thankful for her because she told Bonnie, if he would have treated me that way, the way your dad treated that woman, I would have done the same thing. And from that point on, because she validated what mom did, it then became acceptable to talk about. But that was so important that we had her validation that it was okay to talk about it. And so, you know, we kind of have been real open about it ever since that time.
And how do you think that being open about it has helped you on your journey since this discovery?
Well, I think first of all, it validates me. It validates me as a person because, you know, what mom did was wrong. What bio dad did was wrong. The action that they did was a mistake, but I don't look at myself as a mistake. And I think somehow had we had to continue to live this lie as a family and keep it quiet, I think it would have just eaten me to my core, because I'm very open about it. I talk to people about it. Like I said, I've been in therapy for it. I share my story. I'm not afraid to share my story with people because quite honestly, we're going to find other people as we go. Imperative for my own mental health that it'd be acceptable to talk about within my own family that I grew up with.
What's your relationship with your sisters like now?
I wouldn't say anything has changed except for my behavior. And what I mean by that is I think I'm more withdrawn than I was in the past. Karen will tell you that when she was growing up and when I was born, I was basically a live baby doll to her. And so Karen and I have been close my entire life and we're still close. I don't want to imply that we're not, but I will say that I don't have as much contact with her as I've had in the past, even though we did spend Thanksgiving together, for an example. But that's been more or less because of me and trying to deal with the emotional trauma to myself and not to others. But I have to understand, too, that they're grieving, too. And that's took me a long time to realize that, because for a long time, I just thought my siblings just, you know, it didn't really register with them because it didn't really affect them. But as time's gone on, I realized that they also grieve because of what happened. I'll tell you a funny little story because it has taken us all a, a very long time to come to the realization of what happened. So, and even the day before Thanksgiving of this year, we being Karen and myself, were talking, and DNA came up again. And she said, hey, with the differences with our father, look on your profile, et cetera, et cetera. And that just kind of more validated that, you know, people are becoming more and more accepting of what's happened. And, you know, it's nothing we can do. It's nothing we can change. Just that simple act of right out of the gate acknowledging that we do have different DNA. It was a very comforting feeling to me.
Oh, that's really nice. You know, I really like what you said about recording your bio dad and literally, you know, videoing him so that you had that memory of that connection. And I thought that was a really great idea. And I know you touched on therapy. What are some other things that you've done to help yourself heal through this process?
I think the biggest thing for me is outside of therapy, and I've had, I've suffered from clinical depression my entire life. And so, you know, therapy is not new to me, nor is antipsychotic medicine, so to speak. But the thing that's really helped me the most is I'll tell anybody who will listen, and I tell them not because I'm trying to embarrass mom or anything of that nature. I tell them because it simply makes me feel good to let my friends know the genuine Mike and that this is the real me. And I've been very fortunate, being on the Facebook groups, I hear some really, really negative things. Outside of Michael and Carol choosing not to meet with me, I have not had any negative experiences with it. I haven't had any friends say anything that I thought was out of line. None of my siblings I grew up with, I didn't think have ever said anything that is out of line. So to me, it's definitely talking about it and processing it has been the biggest thing for me.
Definitely. Definitely. So where would you say that you are now with your journey? Are you at peace? Do you feel like you still have more work to do? Where are you at currently?
Right now, I'm worse than I was in 2017 when it was confirmed. I think looking back on that, I went through the initial shock of it being confirmed. Went through the anger and that sort of thing. And then I suppressed it. And I just suppressed it and suppressed it and suppressed it. And so August 12th of this year was the anniversary of mom's death. She had been died 3 years ago. And 5 days after that, I went to the psychiatric ER and I said, I need help. I really need help here. And, you know, of course, they sat me down and they said, okay, what's going on? And one of the first questions was, when did you start feeling this? And I said, last Thursday. And as soon as that word Thursday left my mouth, I went, that was August 12th. That's the day mom died. But it took me 5 days after that for that to come to light. And so I was in a really bad place. Emotionally and mentally. And so I was referred to a program called Partial Hospitalization Program, PHP. And basically what it is you go to therapy, group therapy, 5 days a week for 6 hours a day. And I went there and I really struggled. I did that for about 5 weeks or so. Every day. And that was really difficult. But during that period of time, not only was I, you know, getting over, you know, mom's death, and then bio dad's death, anniversary of his death came up while I was in that program. And I was exhibiting a lot of anger toward mom for not telling me, for not trusting me to sit me down and tell me the truth. And so I went through really, really bad period of time where I just felt, you know, that everything she did 1,000 good things for me as a child and as an adult also, but this counts as 1,001 bad things because it was that big. And so, you know, during the course of group therapy, processing it and what have you. And then also, obviously, individual psychiatric therapy along with a counselor. I'm moving along, but I'm not where I need to be. But I will say this, the last time that I spoke with my counselor, two times ago, or maybe three times ago, she had given me a worksheet. It was an 11-page worksheet and about forgiveness. And she said, I want you to read page one, and I want you to answer the questions on page two. And I said, okay. So our next meeting, I said, I'm not there yet. I can't do this. I'm not ready. And she said, okay. She goes, everybody's on their own timetable. That's okay. Second meeting after that, I said, well, I did go back and read page one again, but I can't answer those questions on page two. I can't do it. And she said, okay. So this past week, I met with her, and I said, I still haven't done that worksheet. I said, but for the first time throughout this entire process, I'm ready to forgive Mom for what she did and what she didn't do. And I said, I'm not far enough along right now to sit down and do the worksheet, but I am far enough along now to say it's only hurting me. I'm the only one being hurt by hanging on to this. And no matter how long I hang on to it, it's not going to change the situation. It's not going to bring Mom back. Nothing's going to change by me holding on to it. And so for the first time in this whole process, I think once I get through that, that'll be a huge step. But I'm just not there yet, but I'm coming along. I'm better than I was in August.
I wish you the best of luck, you know, just continuing. And I think it's really courageous that you talk so openly about, you know, mental health and seeking support. I think it's, you know, can be so stigmatized, especially among men. And so I think it's really great that you're setting that example and seeking help and support for yourself where you need it.
And, you know, one of the things that we hear, you know, one of the things that we hear with NPEs all the time is the identity. We've lost our identity. So I was 35 years old before I found out that my grandfather, who obviously turned out not to be my grandfather, but who my grandfather committed suicide when I was 4 years old. And I never knew that. I was 35 years old before I found that out. And the way I found that out was Mom and I were just having a general discussion, and Mom being the family matriarch like she was, when that discussion came up, she said, well, I have his death certificate. Let me go get it. So she goes and pulls the death certificate out of the file and comes back up the hallway and hands it to me. And I looked right on there and it said suicide. And I said, I've never been told this. I've never known this. And so at 35 years old, I had already been in counseling. And between Pa and one aunt on Dad's side, that's where I thought mental health issues came from. And so at that time, my son was probably, he would have been in his teen years then. And so I made a commitment to myself that he wasn't going to live the rest of his life not knowing that this is a problem and that we need to address it. And so since that point on, him and I have had a real open relationship when it comes to mental health. And that's something I feel very strongly about. And, you know, it's no different than if you have a bad back or you have a bad kidney or you have a bad knee. I just happen to have a bad brain. And that's just the way I look at it.
Yeah, I think that's a really healthy perspective. I want to ask you what advice you might have for a parent who is hiding a DNA surprise from their child. What advice would you give them?
I would say that it's paramount that if you have a loving relationship with your child and in your mind you're doing everything else right in raising that child, you must have this conversation with them. Not all ages are appropriate, and you have to decide when that age is appropriate for them to be able to handle it. but I think it's absolutely imperative that you have it. And it goes way beyond the knowing medical history and all that sort of thing. It's you're living a lie. And probably along the way, you've probably taught your child not to lie. And yet you're living the absolute biggest lie that I can imagine. And so I think it's imperative that to be a good role model and save your child some trauma, you need to have that conversation at some point in their life.
What advice would you give someone who just discovered that they are an NPE?
Step back and take a breath. Because one thing that in the short time that I've been introduced to other NPEs, everyone wants an answer right now, today. And that's not possible. It's the world we live in. You know, we live in the world of technology and the digital age where we can get instant answers. And it's not something you can get an instant answer to. And so I think it's first thing you need to do is take a step back and take a deep breath and try to process it. The second thing I would encourage people to really think about is understand that you're disrupting somebody else's world also if and when you make contact with your biological father. Of course, biological mothers happen too, but just not as frequently. But when you reach out to that biological parent, understand that there's other lives that are going to be affected. And they're strangers to us. They're absolutely strangers to us. We don't have anything in common other than blood. We don't have any of the common backgrounds. And so you just have to be cognizant of that. And I think I've had a little taste of both. As I mentioned, I've had two that have accepted me, and I've had two that chose not to accept me. And so I think I have a good perspective on that.
Michael, thank you so much for being so generous with your story, for talking about mental health and your journey. I wish you the best of luck as you continue throughout this process. And I just really want to thank you for being so open today.
Absolutely. Thanks for your time.
Thanks again to Michael. If you have a DNA surprise story, please email dnasurprises@gmail.com. And if you haven't yet, please rate, review, and subscribe. Until next time.